Blog Talk Radio.
This is the Horse Radio Network.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
Good morning, everybody. I am Glenn the Geek from Lexington, Kentucky.
And I'm Jamie Jennings from Phoenix, Arizona. And you're listening to Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for March 22nd, 2012, episode 364. Good morning, Horse World.
Good morning.
It's Thursday.
Kick the tires and light the fires, Big Daddy.
Your presence is required on the command deck.
Oh, good morning, everybody. Good morning, Jamie. Good morning, Aubrey. Good to see you. We missed you yesterday. And if you guys could all hold on, because somebody won the Powerball last night, and I have to get my ticket out and make sure it wasn't me, because if it is, this show is over. We're playing the closing music, and we'll see you in a week or two. Let's see here.
Dang. Can you at least Powerball give me number, like a severance package or something? Like a big one?
Well, if we won the Powerball, we're moving you to, you can come take care of our horses for us on our big farm. So, well, hold on, I'm just checking the numbers. Okay. Didn't win on that one. I only got two numbers and five freaking lines. Two numbers. And five.
You bought five tickets on Powerball tickets?
Hear this? Wait a minute. Here, listen to this. You hear it?
Is that you ripping
that's
your Powerball ticket?
Yeah.
Dude, that's expensive. I mean, Powerball is $2 a pop right now, and you bought five of them. Let me tell you, that they say that odds are, if you, no matter if you buy one, or you buy five, or you buy 10, or you buy 50, your odds are exactly the same.
It's my one thing. It's my one vice. I spend $5 a week on Powerball. So actually, it was only like three lines. Because you're right, Powerball is expensive now. I usually play the other one, Mega Millions, because it's still a dollar. I don't know why I think $2 is too much.
You should really take up smoking.
No thanks. I'll pass on that, too.
That could be your vice. And you probably get more out of it than buying a Powerball ticket. Oh, just kidding.
I'm just reading now. Somebody in New Jersey won $70 million yesterday. So somebody in New Jersey today is thinking about not going to work.
Yeah, we always do this discussion, whether you would keep working, and you always read those stories about the people that are like, you know, people quit their job and like shoot them the bird, you know, and drive off, or the people that like, you know, you always love the heartwarming stories of the guy who, you know, goes back to the track the next day. The story about the guy the other day that won like $1.4 million and he was a hot walker at the track. So he shows back up the next morning like ready to clean buckets, even though he won $1.4 million. See, those are better stories. You should keep working. It's better for the press.
Right. Well, I would certainly be able to travel more and have more fun stories for the show. That's true.
Like coming to you live from Morocco.
From a horse on top of a mountain in Morocco, overlooking the beautiful sea. Well, seeing that's not going to happen anytime soon. Jennifer, what is happening?
What is happening on today's Maximum Allergens in the Air Thursday? We start with a show jumping history primer. Compliments of the Show Jumping Radio Show. This is a non-credit course, so there will be no quiz at the end. Next up, we will be visiting with vaulting pro riding, not riding instructor. She's going to be vaulting instructor. Ariane, who is one of the clinicians at the upcoming Hoosier Horse Fair in Indianapolis, Indiana. And to round out our little Thursday adventure, the Chronicle of the Horses, Lisa Slade, is here to shed some light on the question that vexes many an equestrian: why do riding lessons cost so freaking much? So stay tuned for the foolhardy fracas, folks.
Hey, yeah, just before I do the Daily Winnies, yeah. You can be fake. God, Jamie, that you are not in Atlanta right now, because we saw a story that the pollen is so bad in Atlanta right now, worse than it's ever been. Usually they do that scale. Well, usually 140 about this time of year on the scale. It's 4,000 yesterday on the pollen
scale. Sounds like
Atlanta. So you would be dying.
You know, I think we
could
be real fair.
You'd be dying.
I don't think that that bothers me all that much, because I think growing up there was, you know, my allergies really got bad. This is going to sound so stupid, but when I got to Arizona, I mean, they were always bad in Atlanta, but Arizona is like worse. I don't know why. Dust, lots of dust. And
well, you know what?
Sand.
It was probably, I was going to say, you're allergic to sand. You're living in the perfect place there, Jamie. Well, my Daily Winnie goes out to all of the hosts on the Horse Radio Network. And the reason is we have gone over 2,000 episodes now for the Horse Radio Network. That's 2,000 episodes. And I'm very proud to say that in 3.5 years on all the different shows we've done, total of 11 different shows, we have never missed an episode. And week in, week out, we have put shows up, whether, you know, sometimes it's been a best of, but we have never missed a week. And for a podcast, that's almost unheard of, because most podcasts don't take very seriously putting shows out every week. And that's one of the things I insisted on when we started the network. And when I think back to Helene and I doing the Stable Scoop show and the first show we started, and us saying, okay, we're probably going to get 20 weeks into this, get bored and we'll quit. You know, when I think back to that, it's amazing how far we've come with over 2,000 episodes. And thank you, too, Jamie, for 364 of them.
Oh, my gosh, I know. I can't believe we've done that many. That's crazy.
I know. It is hard to believe. It is hard to believe.
So,
well, yours is coming up. Yeah.
Okay. Give me mine. It's going to surprise you. All right, well, my Daily Winnie today goes out to 4 people: Jessica, Colton, Philip, and Elise. Do you know who Jessica, Colton, Philip, and Elise are, Glenn and Jennifer?
Not yet.
No.
Come on, you've got to know this. Don't you watch the show? It was on last night. For the first time this year, I watched American Idol. I watched American Idol because my husband is out of town.
Don't tell me. You watched American Idol? Really?
Yes. Well, Chad's out of town. So I was like, well, it's my turn to watch, because he kind of gets a little irritable, if you will, about the whole reality show thing. So I watched. Oh, my gosh. Those 4 children are so talented that I could not believe it. I just could not believe it. It was just awesome, the 4 of them.
They have a good group this year.
Well,
they have a good group this year.
I didn't think so.
Yeah, you voted?
I voted for 4 people, because I was like, I only voted once for each, but every vote counts, right? But the one, I think it was Elise. I was crying at the end of hers because it was so touching with her family. Her family was sobbing, and it was just great. And then the guy Colton, like on the piano. So did you DVR it? You haven't watched it yet?
No, I always watch it the day after. I always watch it tonight, and then I'll watch the award show at the same time, so I get them both together. I cannot stand to watch American Idol because the commercials, they have 5 minutes of show and 5 minutes of commercials. So I always DVR it. It's just too many commercials for me.
Well, I don't know. I really like it. Is there anybody on that show that you particularly don't like?
Yeah, I don't like the Asian guy. I can't remember his name.
Yeah.
And he's still on.
No, I don't think he'll be on much longer.
I don't know how he got this far.
He will not be on much longer.
He has been bad every week. Oh,
yeah.
He's been bad every week, and every week he keeps coming back, and it's like, oh, get rid of him already. No, he's not my favorite, for sure.
Go ahead.
Now,
listen,
I'll tell you who my favorite is. Now that,
can you hear me?
I was going to tell you my favorite. Yes, I can hear you.
Okay,
sorry, go ahead.
Who's your favorite?
I'm looking up his name. I can never remember names. Go ahead. I'll look it up in the meantime.
Well, I was just going to say about the Asian guy. Let me just let you know that if he is on that show tomorrow, I will be so surprised. I won't tell you what he did, but he kind of, I could see where he was going with it, but he kind of made an ass out of himself. So you will, you'll see. Actually, the first, like, just a couple seconds panicked me. Oh, anyway. These are not horse talk, but it's just, you know, a little bit of pop culture within our horse radio show.
Well, you know what, though? We do know that we have a lot of listeners that have posted on our Facebook page that they watch American Idol. Jessica is by far my favorite. She has every week come out. I don't know how she did this week, but she has been absolutely terrific. And she's this tiny little girl. I mean, skinny, tiny little girl, and has this huge voice, and she's only like 16 years old.
Yeah, she blew it out of the water last night. She was one of my daily winnies today. Philip Phillips was amazing. Elise was ridiculous. Jessica and Colton. The four of those are going to be the final four. Just mark my words. They were so much better than everybody else.
Oh, no, you missed one who really stood out from everybody last week, the show you didn't see. He was hands above everybody and has been almost every week, and that's Joshua. He sort of has that Southern Baptist church vibe going, and last week was unbelievable. I believe he's going to be in the final two. I don't know.
He wasn't very good last night, but I must say that who is the guy that looks like Milli Vanilli? Oh my gosh, painful.
With the one with the hair?
Know who Milli Vanilli is?
I don't really know who he is. DeAndre is the one with the curly hair that's sort of like Tiny Tim. He kind of reminds me of Tiny Tim.
Tiny Tim, like the little crippled guy in The Christmas Story?
No,
the singer.
No, Tiny Tim's way before your time. He's way before your time.
Oh, like the little
guy. I can understand why you don't know who Tiny Tim.
No, he looks like Milli Vanilli to me.
Okay. He's not very good either. I don't like him. I don't know how he's gotten this far. All right, enough American Idol talk. Let's get on to horses.
Okay. Well, hey, am I having some audio problems? Should I hang up and call back again?
You were
fading out pretty regularly
there.
All right. Well, talk amongst yourselves. I'll be right back.
Yeah, so why don't we... I'll tell you what we'll do. We're going to go to a little segment that we wanted to bring you from the Jumping Radio Show while Jamie gets back to us here. And Jennifer, you can introduce this little segment. We wanted to share with everybody because you thought it was so fantastic. So,
was very interesting. Chris on the Jumping Radio Show has been doing a lot of Olympic-related interviews and stories and topics, and she's been chit-chatting a lot with folks who are either involved with the upcoming London Olympics or have been involved with previous Olympics. And Richard Jeffrey, who is a course designer, came on and did a couple of different segments. I think this is the second one in the series, about the evolution of show jumping as it pertains to course design. And he touches on the materials they use, the design, in other words, what they look like, how the tracks, which is the course, you know, the layout, whether it's a figure eight or a twirly gig, have evolved over the years. And it's a very interesting look back. And I appreciated it because I've never competed actively in show jumping. I do show jumping because it was part of eventing. And I learned a lot about where the sport came from, and I've earned a new appreciation for what it is now. I find I enjoy watching show jumping more because I know a little bit more about how it got where it is. That's your cue to hit the button.
All right, terrific. Let's take a listen. This is, Yep, this is from episode number 104.
And Richard Jeffries joins me now from England. Hi, Richard.
Good afternoon.
How are you this week?
Just fine. I'm enjoying a little time off.
We're going to continue with the series that we started last month on the evolution of show jumping course design for the Olympic Games, because we introduced it in the January show. And I wanted to, you know, continue this leading up to the Games, Richard, because as we talked about when we last spoke, it is such an interesting journey, isn't it?
It really is, to the fact that when you look through the whole lot, there seem to be like three different groups. We see the beginning very much repetitive up to the Stockholm Olympic Games in 56. And then just before the Los Angeles Games with Bert and Emissi, they changed, the course has changed again, come up to the present day. So it really has been sort of like three groups of course tracks, if you like, during the 100-year period.
It's as if it's gone through three phases in its maturity, really.
Yes, I mean, from, I say, the early, very sort of outside line diagonal hunter type courses to, you know, to modern day, very technical type tracks.
And of course, as we said before, this has influenced so many levels of the competition anyway. It's not just at the top level, at the Olympic level. So going back to the very earliest days then, Richard, 1912, is that the first Olympic Games where there is any record? Now, I know you've done a lot of research on this. So what was the earliest competition, the earliest Olympic Games that you were able to find information about?
Well, we always assumed the 1912 Stockholm Games was the first one. But in fact, back in the 70s, it did find some documentation that the Paris Olympics of 1900 had something which they called prize jumping. There's no actual record of the actual track, but I have seen a picture that's reputed to come from there of a cavalry officer jumping a fairly flimsy pole that looks like over an open ditch. So, but we do know there was a competition, and in fact it was won in a time of 2 minutes 16. So obviously it was quite a long course. But more than whatever has been documented of the Paris ones was the fact there was a long jump and a high jump. And we do know a lot more about these because up to recently, the FEI rulebook had a drawing of how these jumps were to be constructed.
That's interesting. I mean, then the materials, of course, would be different in those days anyway, wouldn't they?
Well, as far as the long jump goes, it's just like a regular water jump. And it would have a brush as a takeoff in front of it. And what they would do as they go through the different rounds, they would add more brushes in the face of it to make it longer and longer. And it had some rails at the side that made it more look like a chute. And in fact, in the Paris Olympics of 1900, it was actually, they jumped 20 feet, 6 meters 10 on that one. And then if we go on to the high jump, we had two competitors jumping 6'1". And in fact, this is quite an interesting jump because back in 78, I was working at the Olympia Horse Show here in London, and Nick Skelton attempted and broke the British record of it. And we actually reconstructed the jump as per the SEI drawing. And in fact, if you go on, Google Nick Skelton, and the horse was called Lastic and probably High Jump, there is a video on the internet showing him jumping this jump.
Yes, I remember that image very well. Now, talking about the course designs, Richard, how were you able to track down those very early course designs? Because that must have taken quite a bit of research.
Well, it started really in 84 at the Atlanta Olympics when Paul Beyer, who's from Switzerland, was our chief steward. And he was putting together an exhibition for the FEI at the IOC's museum in Lucerne. And he asked me for a copy of the drawings because I was helping Linda Allen there and doing all the paperwork. So I gave him a copy of all our courses and said, oh, you know, this is interesting, and any chance that if you, you know, you've got any other courses, I'd be interested in having them, looking at them. And lo and behold, a few months later, I had this lovely package from him with a lot of drawings in them. Some of them were hand-drawn that he'd obviously taken off some documents that he'd been obtained. Others were actual copies of the course plans. And then ever since then, I've just kept my eyes open and, you know, the odd document has appeared somewhere or read some notes and gradually sort of accumulated different ones. We're still missing a few, but we've got a pretty good idea of what went on during the last 100 years.
The last 100 years, that's fantastic. Now, let's also consider the course designers, Richard. Do you have a record of all those designers through the years or just within your memory?
Just within my memory, but I think they are documented somewhere, and we could probably, before we get to July this year, be able to, you know, find them. The first, I certainly know that they were never documented until the Olympics in Los Angeles, which was it 32, and that's the first time a name cropped up. Before that, I think it was just called Clerical Courses, but equally up to then, it was just a standard course that was used every year. I'd say it was very much an outside line, diagonal line, diagonal. And the first drawing we got of that, of course, is the 1912 Stockholm, because that's where really show jumping started. As I said, Paris, we had the long jump, the high jump. Then the following Olympics was, in fact, held in St. Louis over in the States, which is a part of the World Fair there, but had no equestrian events at all. And then we really have to thank Count Clarence von Bonsen, who was the master horse to the King of Sweden, who persuaded the IOC to include equestrian events in future Olympics. And that was just before the London Olympics of 1908. But they felt they never had enough time to organize it, so it was left to Stockholm in 1912, when we really saw the first of the show jumping courses that we now see every Olympic Games.
So let's take that one then, those early examples, 1912 in Stockholm, where those courses, the design was very simple. It was just a figure of eight, wasn't it, Richard? It was very plain.
Yes, well, I'd say it's just like a hunter course these days. There was 15 numbered obstacles, and you kind of sort of went around the outside and then dig a diagonal and then the other diagonal, and you end up down to the middle. But the jumps themselves were interesting because obviously all these courses were held in the main Olympic Stadium. So if anyone can imagine, you know, an ordinary stadium with a running track, the course would be built in the middle of that. And interestingly enough, up to, I think it was 1980, it was always the last event to be held at the Olympic Games. And this goes back to the old Olympics, where the chariot race was always the last event. So this was the chariot race was sort of the equestrian event of the old Games. So to carry that on, you had the show jumping, the final show jumping in the main stadium. When you look at those early drawings of those jumps, there were like what in the painting we would call a sunken road and ditches. I mean, there was one jump where you dropped into like an 18-inch drop and did probably three or four strides before you jumped out again. So presumably they just excavated these jumps out of the arena you know, for the event.
Yeah, it's extraordinary, isn't it? Because as you said, you referenced the eventing there. It really was like a cross-country course, wasn't it? And very rustic, I mean, in terms of it was more rural than it was colourful, wasn't it?
Very much. I mean, you know, there's one pitch I looked at. It looks like it's a stone wall with small stones on top. I'd say another, you know, that you had a water ditch, which obviously these days we call a Liverpool, but certainly you have that and hedges. But obviously no coloured rails. They were either natural, or I think they were some of the pitches I've seen, they're solid white, but not striped like we know show jumps are these days.
So what would you attribute as being those early influences for those designs way back then, Richard, that they were just thinking, well, jumping is something we do cross-country, we don't jump coloured poles, or at least they weren't then. What's your theory behind that?
Well, a lot of it also was that it was only the military riders that took part in these. It was only open to those. No ladies allowed to compete. And I think that was up to about 1952 is when it changed to allow civilians and ladies. So you had the military. And, of course, all these horses in those days were used go to war. And obviously, time at the moment with War Horse just out, the Spielbergs give you an idea of, you know, what the horses had to do in an endeavor. So I'm sure, you know, a lot of the influence of these jumps were what they'd have to jump in cross country.
Well, that was from the Jumping Radio Show, and it was Chris Stafford talking to Richard Jeffries, and that was from episode number 104 of the Jumping Radio Show. Fascinating. I think we should bring back chariot racing for the Olympics, though, and we should have the little knives and spikes that stick out of the wheels and all that stuff. That's just my thought. Jamie, are you there?
Yeah, that's exactly what I think of when I think of chariot racing is the gladiator, when, like, they have the big, long spikes on the chariots and they cut the one lady in half.
Yes, exactly.
So Ben-Hur. Gladiator, Ben-Hur, well, same thing.
Well, a couple news stories before we get to our first guest here today. One neat thing that they're doing over in England is they're giving 3,700 free Olympic tickets to school children around the country, so they'll get to come in, and one of the events that they're going to get to watch is the equestrian events that are going to be held in Greenwich at the park there. So that's kind of cool. It was neat during the World Equestrian Games here in Lexington. Alltech had bought tickets for, I think it was 40,000 school children to come in during the World Equestrian Games from all over Kentucky, and they got to come in, and let me tell you, they were everywhere at that park. We saw them every day. There were tons of school kids, but what a neat experience that they got to see and experience the World Equestrian Games and everything that entailed, and now these kids are going to get to go to the Olympics for free. I love that idea, and I think it's great that they're doing it.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. I didn't put this for you to see, Glenn, but I want to ask our listeners, and maybe we can put a link to this article. It's on Horse Nation, and would you, Jennifer or Glenn, would you wear a piece of jewelry that was made out of your horse's hoof?
No.
Stinky hoof? No, I wouldn't wear stinky hoof jewelry.
It's not stinky, though. Okay, so apparently this chick saw it in the magazine Horse Illustrated. She picked up the magazine because Totalist was on the cover. And the article is quite funny because she's like, yeah, I've never bought a magazine because of somebody on the cover until it was a horse. So she's got to find this magazine, and she found a website called a company called Equinite Gems. And what that is they make jewelry out of horse hoof. And they take what she did is she had to wait for the farrier to come. He trimmed, I guess, according to their specifications, a piece of the hoof. She had like this bleaching kit that she was supposed to use. She bleached it up and then mailed it off, and now has a ring made out of her horse's hoof. And it's actually really pretty. Like, it kind of looks like tiger's eye stone. You know what a tiger's eye looks like?
Well, you know what? I'm on their website now. You're right. It is kind of pretty the way this stuff polishes up.
Yeah, it's not bad. I kind of think it's cool. But apparently a lot of people think it's kind of creepy to have a horse hoof on your ring. But I kind of like the idea. So this is, you know, like when you put your horse to sleep and you have to say goodbye and then you get the hair. And lots of people have very creative ways to display the mane or tail or whatever. This is actually kind of something that will look nice, and you can keep it with you all the time.
And what's real, I didn't realize that you can send your own hoof piece in, and they'll make it out of your own hoof horse clipping or hoof clippings. Hoof.
I should not have done this story to you, because every time you say hoof, it drives me absolutely crazy. I'm not the only one. Yeah, but I went to the website. It's called Equinite or Equinite.com, EQUINITE.com. And they have, the front page is like, because you love your horse. And they can, in 3 weeks, do custom jewelry for you with your horse's hoof. It's crazy. $50, I think, for a custom something from your own horse. And then they do bracelets and rings and necklaces and pendants. And you can get, Glenn, not that you'd ever wear them anywhere, you can get horse hoof cufflinks.
Yeah. Glenn was the cufflink king back in the day, I will have you know.
Yeah, when I used to wear my suits to work every day, I loved cufflinks, but that hasn't happened in about 15 years.
What are you wearing
they are
right now?
They are pretty. I like them,
that
actually. They're pretty. Yeah, I like them. I think
not bad. Let's put a link to that on our, maybe a link to Equinite.com if you don't. Oh, well, there you go. You've already got it up there. Good Lord, you're good, Jennifer. So, yeah, I love it. It's fantastic. I'd buy. I want to find out how much it is to send in a thing and get a brace, to get a ring or something. Let's see here. It's not very expensive as far as custom jewelry goes. You know, it's kind of easy
to
come by a piece of hoof. Huh? Yeah, we should get them on the show. That'd be awesome.
All right, another great product is Holland Horse Tack. And you used another one of their products we haven't talked about yet on a regular basis. Tell us about that.
Yeah, they have what's called the Indra back pad, and it is a therapeutic pad that has brought relief from back problems to thousands of horses all over Europe. And they brought this innovative gel pad to the United States. Now, what I really like about this gel pad is, you know, you get them, and you know, I've just had experiences where they were just kind of like that. You put the saddle down and the gel squishes away from the pressure points. You know what I'm talking about? Have you ever had that problem?
Yeah,
this
exactly.
Actually is a super thin pad, and I've used it. We've used it tons now, and it has not changed a bit. It comes, it's very thin, and it's considerably heavy for how thin it is. So, you know, it's kind of like stout. It's not just going to, like, you can't take your fingers, this is probably like for more visual, but you take your fingers and squish it down, and you can't feel your fingers through the squishiness, you know what I mean? Like, it's very thick for being so thin. And we have a horse here, his name is Chili Pepper, he's one of my lesson horses and my border's horse, and he constantly, chronically has back pain. And that's not a great thing for a lesson horse, because you kind of have to have, you know, actually the back pain predated the riding lessons, so I can't say it's my students that are giving him back pain, okay? He's just actually really long-backed and has bad hocks. So he now wears the Indra back pad. And I'm not kidding you. He's had it for a month, and the kids would always go, he doesn't like it when I brush his back, And they're using the shedding blade on him right now because he's really hairy pony. They're using the shedding blade on him now. He just doesn't care at all. So I really think that the Indra back pad is actually helping prevent his back pain and taking it away. So it's a therapeutic pad. Holland Horse Tack is where you can find it. It's the pad for horses with back soreness. It's at hollandhorsetack.com.
Well, thank you, Jamie. And, you know, speaking of back pain and pads, there's a particular discipline in the horse world that you have to really have a good pad. And that's because they're going to be jumping around on the horse's back. And I, during the World Equestrian Games, I have to tell you that one of the big surprises for me was a sport that I hadn't spent much time watching, and I absolutely fell in love with during the World Equestrian Games. And maybe because it was air-conditioned and comfy it was just a beautiful venue with the world's top doing this, but that's vaulting. I really fell in love with vaulting during the games. I watched every competition every day and covered that. Samantha said, you go do vaulting. And I the first day I went, I don't really want to do vaulting. And then I fell in love with it. So we have a guest on here today. Her name is Ariane. She's an instructor at Vaulting Pro, and they're going to be at the Hoosier Horse Fair here shortly in April doing demonstrations, and they have something really cool they're going to do, and we're going to talk to her about that. Good morning, Ariane.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, no problem. And I got to tell you, I'm not just saying that. I really liked vaulting when I was there. The kids were so enthusiastic. Now, granted, it was the World Equestrian Games, and I was seeing the best of the best doing this. But
yeah.
It was amazing to watch the really good ones doing it.
Yes, that's, of course, it's nice to see. They're definitely Olympic level. It is very exciting to see them. You can see them very often all over the nation. They have actually a friendship team where they come around, cruise around. Of course, our kids are not at this level yet. Therefore, we are just too young of a group. But it's very exciting for each level. It doesn't matter how old they are.
I have a lot of questions for you that came up in my mind as I was watching that during the games. And one of them is, do you get kids that start out that know about horses and have ridden horses? Is it better to have ridden a horse, or is it better to get the kids that just have more of a gymnastics background and have never been on a horse before?
To answer the question, the best thing would be to refer to Megan Benjamin. She was 2006 world champion for women in the single division, and that girl started with 10 years old, and she had no knowledge from either discipline, nor horseback riding or gymnastics. So it does not matter. We start the kids at around 5 years old. They get an unbelievable balance and security on the horse. Some of them are staying with vaulting, and some of them going on our other disciplines.
You know, most riders that see vaulting go, I spend an entire lifetime trying not to do what you're doing on those horses. They just, you know, like Jamie in eventing, she does not want to do vaulting on her horse because that's an involuntary thing that's happening when she ends up doing vaulting. And you guys are doing it on purpose, although I think Jamie's probably done it a time or two. How do you learn? Where do you begin? Where do you start? You know, how do you not break a bunch of bones when you're getting started doing this is my real question.
Well, first of all, this sport is along in Germany and European countries since over 80 years. And we brought it over 40 years ago. And it was actually meant for, at first, for other disciplines to first, if you guys know, lunge line, to get a secure seat, that you don't fall off. That all comes from vaulting, actually. So what we do is basically we start them out on the ground. We have a barrel horse, and the kids will learn first, to be very soft on the horse, because it's not just getting any horse around and playing around. It is definitely that we're trying to teach them horsemanship, that they're very, very soft. If you've seen the high-level vaulters, they barely touch the horse in terms of that they don't even notice it. Of course, little kids don't start out like this, so we're going to use on the beginning, while through all the training in their years, the barrel, before they're even allowed to get on the horse.
And do they start off on the big drafts to start with, the big draft horses? Because you tend to use draft horses warm bloods.
Yeah. Well, I have to say that if you see the high-level vaulters and in Europe, nobody uses draft horses. Over here, we have to, because we are limited on warm bloods. And I'm sure a lot of people paying a fortune for their horses. And so a lot of people start out with draft horses, because their disposition, which is the most important thing, is, of course, outstanding. Now, the downfall on that horses is to keep them in shape. They're just not made for canter. So while you're going along with training, you're going to realize that you do need very light horse. It doesn't have to be a fancy warm blood, but we need a 3-beat canter. That's extremely important. Otherwise, we're being scored on how the horse measures, how the horse behaves, and the most important, the gait, which is almost 30% of all score. And that could just pull you down if you did an outstanding performance in your horse, like most draft horses do in a 4-beat, then, that pulls you down.
Yeah, and you know, when I was watching that, and you do see, and we owned Percherons before, big Percherons, and keeping them at a canter for any period of time is not their favorite thing to do because they're really bred to do a walk. They're bred to pull plows, exactly. They're bred to pull wagons, and they're bred to do it at a very slow, at a slow walk, at a trot maybe. So
right.
When you get them cantering, it's kind of unnatural for them.
Yeah, and it takes a lot of work. That's why in vaulting, a lot of my background is dressage. I rode Grand Prix in Germany when I was very young. And first you're learning vaulting there because it's so good for this kid to have this balance, this independent balance. And they just move on in any stable I'm going. They're just amazed how quick they move on from that to any discipline. So we started there. But we're using lighter horses because of exactly that reason. And, you know, more and more people realize and learning correctly how to lunge to bring the horse in shape and having a well-rounded horse. That is the most important thing.
Go ahead, Jamie.
Just a question to clarify. You've mentioned that they start on the barrels. How long are they on the barrels before they ride? And then you mentioned pulling them down. What do you mean by that?
I'm sorry, that is my language. I think my language barrier is safe from German. I apologize for that.
Oh, no.
How I learned it, and everybody does, of course, differently, but for security reasons, I keep my kids for the first month completely off the horse. They have to learn first safety, top number one thing for me personally. They have to learn that this horse is their partner, and not an instrument or, you know, it's a live animal. They have to learn the horsemanship skills next to the barrel. On the barrel, of course, they learn the moves. We have compulsory, that's 7 moves. They have to learn that. And then when they are good in that, then I'm going to let them in walk. Of course, on our small horses, you're going to, I heard that you guys on the Hoosier Horse Fair, you're going to see them. We have a pony for the beginning, and then we're going to move up the level.
So
well,
we're
going
to see a lot.
They have a neat thing, Jamie, coming up at the Hoosier Horse Fair. They have a neat thing they're doing, and it's in conjunction. I guess you're doing this with the Indiana Equestrian Riding Club, the opportunity for kids to get to do this? Did
yes,
I read that right?
This year, and I'm so glad and happy that the Hoosier Horse Fair helps us out with this. We had the idea. We need to spread the word, of course, from vaulting and to show people more how beneficial it is for each stable because people just plain out don't know. So we wanted to bring it out, and we have 60 scholarships for underprivileged children. And here in Hamilton County, it turned out we have really a lot of kids who are living on the street who don't know, you know, what they do in the next day. Their life is just so different, and we have this idea to just give them a day with horses to just completely, you know, focus on horses. And the Hoosier Horse Fair is a great event. They can see so many things. We're going to have them in clinics. They're going to be not on the horse on that event, of course. As I said, I'm very big in safety, but we're going to do a lot of fun with the barrel. We one of the things, and I would love to, if anybody wants to know, I would love to help them out. We're playing extremely a lot of games depending on the age. We have a few clubs coming, few new starters from outside the country, from Kentucky and Ohio and Chicago, to just learn. This event is basically to learn for other people. What can I do in my stable to establish vaulting? What do I have to do? How I get started? Because it's overwhelming on the beginning. And thanks to the Hoosier Horse Fair, we are being able to provide kids on top of that with 60 scholarships so they can, you know, see all the clinics and demos and just having a great day and get something to eat. And thanks to our sponsors who are coming more and more in, one of the major sponsors we have here, he will provide them even with the necessary school supplies. And we're talking about American kids. We're not talking about outside anybody help. This kid lives here in Hamilton County, and I was totally shocked, and I'm so grateful to the Hoosier Horse Fair.
Well, that's terrific. I'm glad you're doing that, and I'm excited for you, too, because I think vaulting is one of those disciplines in the horse world that doesn't get enough attention. Obviously, it's difficult. Anybody that's ridden a horse, you know, a lot of us can't imagine doing what you guys do on a horse, let alone two or three or four of you at the same time doing it. And, you know, I appreciate it a whole lot more since I got to see it like I did at the WAG, and I would go watch it again. I just absolutely loved watching it. And you are with Vaulting Pro, and you can find Vaulting Pro at vaultingpro.com. That's their website. The Hoosier Horse Fair is hoosierhorsefair.org, and that's coming up on April 13th through the 15th. So if you're in the area, you can meet Ariane by just heading out there. Check the schedule on their website. We thank you so much for being with us today, and good luck at the Hoosier Horse Fair.
Thank you so much, guys, and you have a great show. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Ariane.
Bye-bye.
And so have you ever done it? Have you ever stood up on your horse and tried to ride or played around when you were a kid like that?
You know, I was fearless and stupid as a child. And I had a POA pony, and it was like, I wonder if I can stand up on her when she's running. That kind of stuff. I always did that stuff. And then the coolest thing about her was she was short enough, I would do a round off of her butt. So I'd stand on her back, put my hands on her butt, and like do a round up and land on my feet. Usually I would land on my butt about 10 feet away because it flung me so far. I don't think I ever stuck a landing, if you will. But when you're 9, you don't care. Like you have you bounce.
Oh, you mean you don't do that today? You don't do that off the back of Jet today?
You know what? I could do that off the back of Jet once, and he would fire away as I was about right where his hawks are, and and that would be the last time. Yeah. He loves me. He really loves me.
Well, today's song is sponsored by Equity Manufacturing, and Jennifer and I have fallen in love with one of their products, and that is the Flex and Fork. And you just got yours, didn't you?
I did, and I got to clean my pasture with it yesterday. It was very exciting.
This thing is amazing. Now, we're talking about a manure fork, okay? You know, we're not talking about something that's overly sexy. We're not talking about something that, woohoo, jewelry. We're just talking about something you clean your poop with. But let me tell you what. We have both fallen in love with this thing, and I'll tell you why. It is tough as nails. We use pellets in our stall. And for Beaker Stall. And pellets are tough to clean sometimes because it's so fine. And when you're using the regular manure fork, the tines are further apart. So the little tiny poop things fall through or they come off the sides as you're shaking. And they just build up in there. And then it gets to be icky after a couple of days and you want to strip it and start over. When you're using the Flex and Fork, you don't have that problem because it collects everything. They have two different forks that you can put at the end of this, and two different baskets, rather. The one is got an extra four tines if you're using pellets or a fine shaving, and that's the one we use, and it gets every little molecule of poop, and it is terrific. It really makes a difference, and it really saves us on bedding. We don't have to strip out our bedding as much. Now, you used it out in the pasture yesterday, right, because you don't have bedding.
I did. I don't use bedding. So what's great about this is, you know, sometimes because I'm in a pasture and the tines will get stuck underneath the grass, you know, like the Bermuda grass, it gets stuck under there and you go to pick it up and bing, the tine breaks off. So I love the manure forks. I can't use like a real pitchfork. Not from the 1920s. I'm not going to use a real pitchfork. I'm going to use one of these things, but I buy them all the time because once one tine is broken, you can't use them anymore because that one little apple falls through, one little poop
exactly.
ball falls right through. So apparently this thing is not going to break. And I will keep you up to date on that because I will tell you the honest truth. And I am out there in the pasture and I'm cleaning horse poo under. And then you go like stab the ground, you know, and then you stab it and ding, the tine breaks off. So I'll let you guys know. I'll keep you posted on because this sucker is going to get used to pieces.
Well, we have one fork. I've got to tell you about this. We have one fork out at the barn that's sitting out there, and Jennifer's going to laugh. It actually has one of the middle. And why is it that the ones that break off are always in the middle and not at the end? That just seems to be a rule, too. But there's one sitting out there that has its tine completely turned over to the side. You think it's bad when they break off? This thing is turned over to the side on the top of the basket. So it just gets in the way of everything you do. And for some reason, they just won't throw it away. I don't know why. But these things are terrific. You can find them at equitymfg.com. They're a little more expensive. It's $49 from Norfolk, but it's going to last you. You'll go through three of the other cheapy ones in the time you go through this one. Plus, it has kind of a shock absorber thing built into it. It's really cool how it works. And so Flex and Fork is the one you want to look for at equitymfg.com. Another new song from the Icy Blue Heart CD. By the way, Templeton Thompson let me know that the CDs are going out to everybody who donated money for this project. They're going out this week, and these songs will come up for sale on iTunes here in the next week or two. She's going to let us know. And we've had you guessing every week who wrote the songs, because these are all cover songs. So today, if you want to post on Facebook who wrote this one, we'd love for you to do that. And here we go.
Yeah.
Well, that's Templeton Thompson, and of course that was the long run. So, Jamie, do you know who did that one?
Oh, of course. You know, that was the Eagles, obviously. And for some reason, that the Eagles, I'm not a huge fan of like 70s rock. The Eagles transcend that. Hotel California, are you kidding me? What a fantastic song. Take It Easy, all of those Eagles songs are awesome.
I agree. You know, we were talking about, I was talking about that with Jennifer this morning, how the Eagles really were kind of different for their day, and they their music just lives on today, and a lot of even younger people like Eagles music. And, you know, that one actually was written with the help of Bob Seger, too. So not only Don Henley and Glenn Frey, but Bob Seger pitched in on that one, and she, of course, did a great job. There hasn't been one of these songs that she has covered that we've been playing over the last many weeks that I haven't liked. She's just done a terrific job with all of them.
What's funny is I actually don't like some of the songs she picked, but I liked her version. Is that weird?
Yeah, well, it's just because we like her, I guess. Well, we apologize for the technical difficulties today. I don't know if it's sunspots or what, but everybody's sound is a little bad and off today, and I think it's Blog Talk, actually, that's having issues. So we're gonna get Lisa on here from the Chronicle early, and we're going to wrap the show early today. This is totally out of our control. There's just nothing we can do about it, and we apologize, and hopefully tomorrow it'll be better. But I wanted to give you a highlight show from the Horse Radio Network, and that's Horse Tip Daily. Jennifer had Kim Wallness on, her old instructor from the old days, and they talked about good intentions and good results, and they talked about how your positive intentions, actions, aids, and even thoughts will have a positive effect upon your riding. Kim always spent a lot of time on the mental aspect of riding, and of course, with any sport, the mental part of it is about 80% of what the final result's going to turn out to be. So it was a very good tip. It was at horsetipdaily.com, episode number 612 tips over there at Horse Tip Daily. So thank you, Jennifer, for producing and editing and hosting that show. That was a very good one. Well, let's go right to Lisa. What do you say, Jamie?
All right. Well, we've got Lisa Slade from the Chronicle, and she's going to talk a little bit about an article that was written in the instructor's perspective on why riding lessons cost so much. It makes me realize I need to raise my prices. But before we get to that,
I don't think Lisa, that was the idea of the article.
Before we get to that, Lisa, I want to just let you guys know that, you know, there's not many times where because I live a life of, like, riding horses and competing, and I don't have any kids, so I don't feel old. But then I see an opportunity come up, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, that would be so awesome. And then I realize I'm too old for it. And what I'm talking about is the casting call that is going out for the equestrian reality TV show. There's going to be a reality TV show about horse people. Can you believe it, Glenn?
And they're not jousting?
No, it's not jousting. Check this out. It's going to explore the lives of young women in the competitive equestrian world. How awesome would that be? I'm a shoo-in. Oh, wait. You have to be 15 to 19. I don't think I can pass for that. Lisa, tell me about this. Do you know anything about this reality show?
Good morning. You know, I don't. This is the first I'm hearing about it.
Oh, it was on your website. You should probably go to chronofhorse.com every once in a while. And
you know, it's funny you guys are having technical difficulties because, like, this has been a morning of technical difficulties for me. I haven't even made it into the office. I'm currently sitting in my car at a gas station. So.
Oh, no. Did you run out of gas or what?
No, I had to, you know, I had a horse lose a shoe, of course. I had to meet the farrier. She was running. She's a wonderful farrier. She was running just a bit late. Things ran long, and so it's just, you know, now it's 10 o'clock, and I'm still not at the office. And, of course, I live in the middle of nowhere, so I can't drive and talk on the phone because I will lose service. So it's just been one of those mornings, basically, which is why I haven't looked at our own website today.
Oh, well, that's all right. That's all right. You know, basically, anytime anything goes wrong, it's because of a horse. It all boils down to your horse through issue. That's pretty much
Yes, that is always the problem. Yeah, so, you know, it's a typical springtime thing. It's been really wet and really gross here. So
do you remember this article then, if you don't have any notes in front of you?
I do. I remember it well because it was really, it really hit home for me. It's very near and dear to my heart because I feel like I spend, I don't know, maybe half my income on lessons.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I thought it was interesting because, you know, non-horsey people, they hear, like, oh, you're going to take a lesson with so-and-so, and they say, oh, that must be, what, $10? And I'm like, no, it's actually $100. And they are sort of astonished at that, which it is astonishing. $100 is a lot of money.
$100 for what, a lesson?
For a lesson, yeah.
Well, I am way underpriced. Because $100 a lesson seems excessive to me, unless you're, you know, riding with an Olympic gold medalist. So is that...
the person I've been riding with most recently that I've been paying $100 is Stephen Bradley.
Oh, okay. There you go.
Yes. I don't know if he has an Olympic gold medal, but he certainly has lots of accolades to his name. And I have to say, he's, like, riding with him has been amazing. He's been worth, you know, every penny. But it's just funny to tell non-horsey people that, and they're sort of like, what kind of racket is this person making? You know, like, they're charging you $100, and then they're charging the next person $100. So the thing I liked about Lauren's blog was it sort of put into perspective how much it costs to get good at riding. You know, you think, like, how much of an investment it is for the person, and then it makes it seem a lot more fair that they can charge you, you know, I think Lauren is somewhere in the $75 range. It makes it seem much more reasonable, I think, if you think about how much money they have had to put into developing their own skills and how much they still have to keep up with doing that, because no one wants to ride with a trainer who's really out of the scene. You know, you want someone who's still taking lessons and still competing and still an active part of everything. And that costs money to make it happen, you know. So I don't know. What do you guys think? Are these prices seeming unreasonable to you? I'm curious what other people pay.
You know, I'm thinking, like, how much I'd pay for a lesson with Barb Crabo. And, you know, she's an advanced inventor competing in Rolex this year. And I pay 50, I think the whole total, it's about $60 a lesson by the end of it with the ship-in fee and then the lesson. And I did think, oh, I decided to start taking some group lessons to help with defray the cost, if you will, as opposed to $50 for a private. You know how much a group lesson costs?
How much?
$48. I was like, oh, great. I saved $2. I got my bill. I was like,
$2.
Oh, well,
you can buy half a coffee now.
Exactly. But with the amount of gas that it takes me, because she's an hour and a half away, with gas prices now, we're looking at $100 a lesson easy. So, you know, like, that's not crazy. I did have a neighbor, a student, who her mother asked me if we could trade out. Like, she's like, I'll cook you guys dinner. I'll bring dinner over if we can just trade out lessons. And I just thought, dude, I have way too much overhead to trade out. You know how much these horses cost me?
And that's the other thing she talked about is even building her facility, which I've been to Lauren's farm, it's absolutely stunning, especially the indoor. It's just like, it's just amazing. It's full of light, and the footing could not be better. You know, the horses just get in there and sort of sigh. And so that's another big thing you think about. If you go to someone's farm and you're jumping their jumps or you're riding in their perfect footing, you know, that all costs them money as well.
So
it's just an interesting way of looking at it.
Like reading the fact that the person, and it's Lauren Spreiser, and she's talking about how much basically you have to pay for, you know, and again, Barb has like this amazing all-weather footing in her jumping arena. And I have what they call reject sand in mine.
Is that really what they call it?
It's actually called reject sand because it's a little grainier than the beach sand, and everybody wants the beach sand and it's tight stuff.
Yep.
I got the grainier stuff. So actually, when I picked the sand, they were like, oh, that's the reject sand. Oh, well, that's great.
Of course, right. So, that's exactly what I want, something that has reject in the title.
Yeah. Well, hey, Lisa, this is a great article. I hope everybody goes to chronofhorse.com. Our sound is just getting worse and worse, so we're going to let you get into the office. Yeah, we're going to let you
Sounds
get into
good.
The office and
not get in trouble.
Yeah, they would probably, my coworkers probably appreciate it if I eventually did make it there.
Oh, yeah, whatever. It's like, show up to work, whatever. All right, well, Lisa, yeah. Thank you so much. We will talk to you again next week, and let's do some research on how we can act 15 years old and get into this reality show.
Okay, that sounds great.
Everybody, cronofhorse.com. Thanks, Lisa Slade.
Yep, thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
All right, well, our sound has gone totally out of the window here, so we're going to call it a day, everybody. We'll be back again tomorrow. Hopefully things will be better. Don't forget Really Bad Ads tomorrow. We have a terrific bareback pad that we are giving away tomorrow from California Equine Products. So this is a pad that's worth a lot of money. So get your entries in, and we'll pick a winner tomorrow when we do Really Bad Ads. Thank you, Jamie. Thank you, everybody, for putting up with the sound issues today. Hopefully, they'll get resolved by tomorrow. That's it.
You know what?
Say goodbye, Jamie. Yeah?
You think the sound is bad? I've just been making popcorn this whole show in the back. The crackling of the microwave popcorn. Now, sorry, you guys. Yeah, I'm going to go eat now. All right, everybody, spay, neuter, and yell. Have a great day. It's so unsatisfying. I need more time.
I know. I have to wait for tomorrow.
My popcorn's ready.
So much more to say.
Doubling up tomorrow.
Popcorn's ready.